or with supremely dependable 17-jewel Bulova movements, all surprisingly attractive in price.
World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you firsthand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
Despite German claims that everything is calmed down inside Germany, there are increasing signs today that the revolt of army leaders is not yet over. The new chief of the German Army General Staff has told his troops by radio that some of the officers who led the revolt were on active service. The German retreat continues along the Eastern Front. Berlin says Pskov, the gateway to southern Estonia, has been evacuated. And the Germans say the Russians have reached the outskirts of Lvov, the German stronghold in southern Poland. In Italy, Fifth Army troops have entered the outlying fringe of Pisa. The Eighth Army has moved within 15 miles of Florence, and the Poles are now 17 miles north of Ancona. In the Pacific, American troops have pushed back counterattacking Japanese defending Guam's port of opera. Now for the latest military developments in France and in Europe, Admiral takes you to London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
On the front, the Germans have been putting in what one correspondent describes as a surprisingly large number of very small counterattacks against our positions in Normandy. There is certainly no indication that the troops there have been particularly shaken by the revelation of a plot to overthrow Hitler. These German soldiers in France, including a high proportion of SS divisions, are fighting very hard. In spite of their stubborn resistance, we have made two small advances. One took the British into the town of Malto on the Orne, 5 miles southwest of Caen. And we took maybe 400 prisoners there and cleaned up that part of the triangle between the Orne and the Odon rivers. The other advance brought the British nearer to Troarn on the extreme right flank of the beachhead. The weather there is much better. The rain has stopped, and there has been enough visibility today to permit a resumption of our air activity. Our planes promptly ranged over the whole area, undoing all the repair work the Germans had been able to do to roads and railways there during the lull. Strong forces of 9th Air Force Marauders and Havocs today dropped bombs on 6 railway targets. Choke points, they call them, in the enemy's transportation system to the battlefield. In spite of the bad battlefield weather, last week was a tremendous one for the Allied Air Forces. In the last 6 days, American heavy bombers sent out more than 6,000 bombers, plus 5,000 fighters, against targets ranging from the Baltic to the Alps. They dropped 16,000 tons of bombs. Aircraft production and oil production were the main targets. The RAF pulled or dropped its weight as well. In one 12-hour period last week, they dropped 4,500 tons. Weather doesn't hold up these big air attacks anymore, and no matter what is happening on the battlefield, the big planes go out just the same. The latest news from Berlin is that 50 German generals were implicated in the revolt against Hitler, a considerable advance on previous protestations of the insignificance of the coup. 50 is a lot of generals. Stockholm reports say that diplomats like von Neurath and bankers like Schott were also in the plot. The whole affair, which is certainly seen as in a glass darkly here in London, is still exciting the most profound interest. It is generally assumed that the rebellion is still going on and that the Nazis have not succeeded in completely liquidating it. This is borne out by Berlin itself, where the absence of information is excused on grounds that investigations are still going on. What everyone wants to know about the German general's plot is simply, what does it mean? So far, no one has told them. The British spokesmen have pursued the sound but uninspiring line that we must wait and see. And meanwhile, people must not become optimistic and certainly must not stop working. However, this week, Winston Churchill is going to make one of his periodic surveys of the war, and everyone expects that he will put the events in Germany in their proper perspective. Of all the world's statesmen, it is probably Churchill who has the most profound sense of history and who can best tell us of the volcanic events in Germany, not only what they mean today, but how they stand in the whole panorama of the war. In the last war, when a similar, though not so public, situation arose in Germany, Marshal Foch's answer was a vigorous and continued offensive until Germany finally broke. That may well be Eisenhower's answer this time. Already there has been growing criticism, and not all of it ill-informed, of the caution which has characterized our operations in France. The possibility of hastening the collapse of Germany, dramatically shown by the action of the German generals, may dictate a more audacious offensive in Normandy. And there may be political moves designed to draw the German people into the movement against the Nazis. But whatever form our military and political action will take, it is inconceivable that we will not attempt to take advantage of this demonstration of German weakness. This is Charles Collingwood in London, returning you to Admiral.
More news in just a moment, but first here is Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
In keeping with good things to come from Admiral, we're going to project a story into the peacetime year of 1940X. A good friend of ours is a great fisherman. Every year he catches more fish than he can possibly use for his own family, so he keeps all his neighbors and friends supplied. But that's all changed in this peacetime year of 1940X, for our friend now owns an Admiral home freezer. So he'll bring all his catch home to be frozen and stored. Then, whenever his wife wants fish on the menu, there it is with all the flavor and freshness frozen right in. She is now more reconciled to his fishing as well as hunting trips because frozen fish and game, always at hand, mean a substantial saving on her food budget during the long months ahead. Yes, when the production of civilian goods is resumed, people all over America will choose the Admiral Home Freezer, made by the same careful craftsmen who have made Admiral Radio America's smart set. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
In China, General Stilwell reported today that Allied air attacks on the Japanese-held Hunan province capital of Changsha caused fires visible 60 miles away, and pilots report the entire city is in flames. At the railway town of Hengyang, where Chinese troops have been holding out against a prolonged Japanese siege, Allied planes bombed the Japanese-held railroad yards, setting buildings afire. Enemy troop positions around Hengyang were hit, and casualties were caused. Japanese shipping was hard hit. An estimated 20 supply boats were sunk in Siang River sweeps from Changsha south to Siangtan, and 150 river craft were destroyed or damaged near Siangtan. And now for the news in the Pacific and an interview with a war correspondent who has spent some time with our battle fleet, Admiral takes you after a brief pause to CBS Pearl Harbor. Webley Edwards reporting.
The island of Guam is shaped like a sock with the toe pointing down. American forces have now pushed in two sizable sectors and are making further progress inland. The northern sector runs along the back of the ankle of the sock, from Adan Point to Adaloop Point. Cabras Island, a splinter of land by the heel, is entirely in our hands, as are the roads along the beach from Agana to Piti Town. The other sector is at the sock's instep. Here our troops have captured and hold Mount Alifan. And Admiral Nimitz says that progress is satisfactory. Just in from Saipan and nearby areas in the forward combat region is Morris Markey, war correspondent and well-known writer for Liberty and Reader's Digest. He was on a carrier of the Essex type during the battles west of Saipan and in the Philippine Sea. How did this greatest air battle of the Pacific War look from carrier deck, Morris?
Well, there's some queer contrasts going to an engagement on a big carrier. Most of the time, you and several hundred other people are just following a routine, getting the pilots and their planes off the deck, and then sweating it out while they fight somewhere beyond the horizon. You feel pretty much out of it, and get to wishing you could see a little of the shooting, too.
I understand you did see a little of it at that.
Yes, that would be a hard morning to forget. It was still just the usual routine until the word came very loud and clear over the speakers. A large formation of enemy aircraft approaching on the starboard quarter. The first thing that happened was the biggest, most spontaneous cheer you ever heard in your life. And then action. Plenty of action. Planes piling off that deck too fast to count them as they went. And all of a sudden, we felt very naked and defenseless, cutting through the water.
Sort of a sitting duck?
Well, not exactly sitting. We were steaming with everything we had, but a duck anyway. Ordinarily, nobody pays much attention to the pilots as they roared down the deck and off. But this day, we felt mighty friendly to them. We gave them the old high sign, thumbs up, and the rest of it. They were very valuable people to us just then.
They had a big day?
Terrific. Our flyers, that was Air Group 15, broke all records for enemy planes shot down in one day. They got 67.
Any particular heroes, Morris?
Everybody up there was a hero to us, the way we felt. But Wayne Murrish, you remember him in the movies, got his first zero. And Dave McCammell, the squadron leader, got 7 Japs altogether. Matter of fact, 5 or 6 of the pilots got to be aces that morning. The fighting kept up all day. Our fellows would come in for deck landings and cool off for an hour in the ready rooms while the plane crews refueled and rearmed their planes, and then get going again. When the last plane came thumping on deck as darkness settled, they leaned back and opened up with a flood of wonderful talk. They were a happy bunch, I can tell you that, but not a bit happier than we were. We were still alive, weren't we? It turned out to be quite a pleasant feeling at that, being alive.
How does the fighting look to you, Morris?
From where I sat, it looked very rugged. Somebody or other has said that the Japanese are third-rate fighting men. I've seen them fight now on land and in the air, in the Marshalls and at Saipan. And no man is third-rate when you've got to kill him to beat him. These people are brave and determined. I am thankful I am able to report that we have the right sort of people out there to slug it out with them and beat them.
So you've heard Morris Markey, war correspondent and writer for Liberty and Reader's Digest magazines, on his way back from the forward fighting fronts in the Marianas to New York. I hope to see you out here again before long, Morris, and good luck to you, boy. This is Wobbly Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
It was officially announced in Cairo today that British and Greek shock troops have successfully raided the Dodecanese island of Sini near Rhodes and have liquidated the entire German garrison. The operation took place the night of July 13th. More than 160 Germans and Italian troops were killed, wounded, or captured. At the other end of the Mediterranean, the 5th Army entered southern Pisa this morning. For a direct report, Admiral takes you now direct to CBS Rome. Eric Severide reporting.
This is Rome. The Allies in Italy are still moving on, not rapidly, but faster apparently than they are in Normandy. American troops last night fought their way to the south banks of the Arno between Pisa and the sea. And at last report, some of them were in the southern outskirts of the city with the Germans still resisting. The 8th Army to the right, after a week's hard fighting in the Tiber Valley, the sea city of Castello, and over on the Adriatic, the Poles continue to push ahead. Our last reported air raid was on the Plesti oil fields once more. Last week, planes from this theater flew nearly 12,000 sorties. They destroyed 155 German planes in the air and lost 139 themselves. Our men should be in complete possession of Pisa very soon, if the usual pattern of conquest is followed. So far as we know, the town is not much damaged, despite German demolition, and the Leaning Tower is still leaning. When we entered Rome, one untutored GI remarked about the old ruins of the Colosseum that we had really given the place a plastering, and it's practically certain that at least one of his comrades will conclude that the Tower of Pisa was not knocked off center by our explosives. A month and a half now, our soldiers have occupied Rome, so often conquered in the past. And as before, eternal Rome absorbs the latest victors in his serenity unimpaired. Rome is lazy and hot as another July. The people take their daily siesta as they did. And today the church bells are ringing as on other Sundays. Never before has Rome been taken by such a variety of races and peoples as this time. But the soldiers you see everywhere are mostly American. The people here, as in Naples, genuinely like us, perhaps a shade better than they like our lives. We have so many more boys with the Italian heritage and tongue than have the British. And as for the French, they cannot quite forget the 10th of June in 1940. Among the Americans, none is better liked than the Negro troop, for the Italians like men who smile and have a gentle way with children. When they first set foot in Rome, our men felt at least some silent wonder and awe among the monuments. But history is not their strong point, and in the pleasures and comforts of modern Rome, they now find their fascination. Rome may be eternal, but even in Rome, a soldier feels that his life is short. The one-night history lovers entering the Colosseum found loudspeakers blaring jazz music from the center of the arena. That, I might add, was stopped. Now, Rome is Rome no longer impresses the average fighting man. He is a little bored, and he thinks of it now as just another rear echelon city, better than most, though, of course, not quite up to Chicago or St. Louis or whatever his town, and another place where nearly all the good hotels are reserved for their officers. Along with the pain, there are many pleasures in war. And even for the Democratic American Army, this is still in that respect an officer's war. If most Romans are really glad to see us and glad to help us, there are some dissenters. Some of the proprietors, for example, who are rapidly marking up prices on the apartments we have been generous enough to rent and not requisition. Some of the wealthy expatriate residents from America and England, to whom the war has been a horror because they had to do their own shopping and dress their own children. They will describe their trials by the hour. But they are always such people. To them, the war had no meaning, nor does now the victory. This is Eric Severide in Rome. I'm returning to Admiral in New York.
Here in Columbia's news headquarters in New York, we've just received a communique from the headquarters of the Eastern Command, the American Tactical Air Force. It says that American 15th Air Force Lightnings and Mustangs in the first all-fighter shuttle operation between Italy and Russia destroyed 56 enemy planes in raids today on the German airdromes north of the Ploiești oil fields in Romania. The Germans continue to report withdrawals along the Great Eastern Front. For a summary of the Red Army's westward march, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
There seem distinct indications that the whole southern half of the German front in the east is crumbling. Late German reports say that the Russians have penetrated to the outskirts of the great railway center of Lvov, that the Russians have also driven a deep penetration north of Lvov, which has reached the River San in the vicinity of Yaroslav, and that still further north, another Russian penetration has reached the area of Lublin, an important railway town about 100 miles southeast of Warsaw. In this area, it now seems likely that the Germans cannot stabilize their front on any line east of the upper course of the River Vistula. Just north of this sector, the Russians have virtually surrounded the great key fortress of Brest-Litovsk and have penetrated deeply between Brest-Litovsk and the railway center of Bialystok, the next important German stronghold to the north. Brest-Litovsk is strongly fortified and may be able to hold out for some time. But here, as on the southern sector, the Russians are going ahead without much regard for leaving centers of German resistance behind them. Still farther north, however, a German bolt position defending the frontier of East Prussia appears to be holding firm. The Bialystok and Kaunas are still in German hands, and no Russian penetration between these points has been reported. Of great interest, however, is the situation in the Baltic states, where a German army group of from 20 to 25 divisions, under the command of Colonel General Lindemann, is now in danger of being cut off by Russian penetrations north of Kaunas. The Germans report the abandonment of the city of Pskov, along their chief bastion just south of Lake Peipus, which may indicate that Lindemann's troops are being withdrawn by the coastal routes through Riga, which are the only land routes still connecting the Baltic states with Germany, or by sea through the ports of Tallinn, Riga, and Libau. The possibility must also be considered that Lindemann's forces may turn south and deliver a counterattack against the northern flank of the Russian armies pressing against East Prussia. This flank is now somewhat exposed to such a German move. This operation would be covered by the fortress of Dvinsk, which is still in German hands, though menaced by the troops of General Yaremenko's 2nd Baltic Army. The immediate course of events in the north may therefore depend on Yaremenko's ability to take Dvinsk within the next few days. Now here again is Douglas Edwards.
You have just heard Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott. And now for news from the home front, and an interview with a naval officer just back from the Pacific, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
The United Nations Monetary Conference completed its work last night, approving an $8 billion fund to stabilize world currencies and a $9 billion bank for international reconstruction and development. The International Bank Agreement will be signed today, and then both plans must be approved by the various legislatures before they can take effect. About an hour ago on this network, William A.M. Burden, an Assistant Secretary of Commerce, announced that the Civil Aeronautics Administration has a $1 billion plan for building 3,000 new airports in the United States, almost doubling the number now in use. The program will be submitted to Congress soon. And the Navy has announced that it plans to boost its manpower strength by 383,000 men above the present authorized total of 3,006,000. More than 2.5 months ago, a combined squadron of Army and Navy liberators made two daring long-distance flights over Guam,
The Navy planes were armed with cameras as well as guns. The Army went along to help protect them during their dangerous mission. This week, when American troops stormed ashore to recover the first American outpost that fell to the Japanese, their commanders had detailed last-minute maps of the island, thanks to the pictures taken by Victor Dog 3. That's Navy for Fleet Air Photographic Squadron No. 3. Here's the executive officer of Victor Dog 3, Lieutenant Commander Edwin L. Keene, USN of Newark, New Jersey. He made both flights over Guam and was one of the last men to see the island before the actual assault began. Tell us what it looked like, Ed.
It's the biggest island in the Marianas, about 24 miles long. There are high bluffs along the eastern shore, and the south is fairly mountainous. But the northern part of the island is a fairly level plateau, about 200 feet high. There are some beaches on the west coast and a reasonably good harbor in Apra Bay. The whole island is heavily wooded.
Well, how about the Japanese defenses, Ed? What are the boys running up against there now?
Well, for one thing, we found two new airfields that we hadn't known about before. The best one was started by the Americans before the war. The Japs completed that, built another one of their own, and started work on a third.
Well, we'll probably be able to make pretty good use of those, won't we?
Yes, but they'll have to be patched up. Between our bombers and naval guns, they've taken quite a pounding. We kept up a steady bombardment there, you know, for 15 or 16 days before the landing.
Well, when you were there, did the Japs send up much opposition?
On the second trip, they did. We saw planes taking off just as we came over the island, and they reached our altitude about the time we finished our photographic run.
Did they get any of your bombers?
No, but we got seven of them. Our gunners were credited with five certain and one probable, and the Army got two. Japs tried hard and threw everything in the book at us, but it was pretty feeble. The only real damage was a 20-millimeter hit that wounded the tail gunner in one of the Army planes. Not seriously.
Well, how about the anti-aircraft fire?
It was pretty piddling.
Well, even at that, I bet you were pretty glad to get out of there, weren't you?
I'll say we were. That was our last flight. After Guam, we had been told that we could go home. We had spent 11 months at Hawaii, at Canton Island, in the Gilberts and in the Marshalls.
And always, I might add, as the real spearhead of the fleet, because these guys with the cameras are always way out in front of the main forces, fighting their way in and out of the lion's mouth time after time, and usually over tremendous distances.
Actually, distance out there was the greatest enemy we had. Our next big problem was bases. Because we always had to keep out ahead, and we had to move up before bases were really completed. For that reason, our squadron had its own maintenance crew, and every member was a picked man.
Incidentally, Lieutenant Commander Keene's squadron also made the advance reconnaissance pictures of Saipan and of Rota and Tinian Islands in the Marianas. So in 11 months, they have photographed a very sizable chunk of the Pacific. I guess that ought to give them a right to a rest back here at home. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral.
There are great things in store for music lovers when peace comes. Record manufacturers will be able to demonstrate many proposed advances in finer, more natural reproductions. And the newer, finer Admiral radio phonographs with automatic record changers will offer the perfect means to bring out all the shadings and overtones so necessary to lifelike interpretation. In pre-war years, Admiral Corporation was the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. And from the vast store of knowledge and research gained by this leadership will come the new Admiral automatic record changer, revolutionary in design and operation. Not so many years ago, record changers had literally dozens of moving parts. But the new peacetime Admiral will have so few that you will hardly believe it. Being leaders in radio, radar, FM, communications equipment, and television, Admiral will offer some brand new ideas in radio, too. All of which adds up to one fact. For a radio phonograph with an automatic record changer that has the best of everything, choose Admiral. America's victory gardeners alone this year are expected to produce about 10 million tons of food. Obviously, all this food can be eaten fresh. To prevent its waste, in a year when food is one of our most important weapons of war, every homemaker is urged to do as much home canning as possible. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WBBM, Chicago, Illinois.